University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents the Honorable Norman Krivosha, Chief Justice of the Nebraska Supreme Court, speaking on education, for the sake of living, as well as making a living. His lecture was the final activity in observance of National Higher Education Week. Judge Krivosha graduated from the University of Nebraska College of Law in 1958. Before his appointment as Chief Justice in 1978, he practiced law, served as general counsel for Lincoln General Hospital and the Lincoln Electric System, and was the Lincoln City Attorney for 2 years.
Welcome to today's forum presentation. We would like, first of all, to welcome a group of visitors from Lincoln's Northeast High School who are on the Wesleyan campus today to get a taste of college during National Higher Education Week. We hope you enjoy your experience with us. As part of National Higher Education Week, faculty members this week have been engaged in a series of discussions on our individual approaches toward discovering what is defensible, what is correct, what is true. Such activities serve a purpose, but a danger in a context such as ours is that self-inspection, introspection, contemplating our own navels, replaces rather than augments attempts to determine the place of higher education in society as a whole. It was with that concern in mind that an invitation was extended to today's speaker, with the hope that he could address himself to higher education from a more detached perspective. He is already well known to many of you. He speaks frequently to groups across the state as part of an effort to raise public awareness about the work of the judiciary. His reputation as a speaker precedes him here. He is witty, forceful, and always engaging. The title of his talk today is Education, for the Sake of Living, as well as Making a Living. A big welcome, please, for the Chief Justice of the Nebraska Supreme Court, Norman Krivosha.
Thank you very, very much. As always, it's a great pleasure for me to be on the Nebraska Wesleyan campus. I know a few things that I'm privileged to do that provides me with as much pleasure as my involvement with this fine university, and I'm particularly pleased to have been asked to participate during the celebration of Higher Education Week. As I begin my address, I'm reminded of the story about the Yale alumnus who was invited to deliver an address at his beloved Yale University. He rose and walked to the podium, looked out at his audience, and said, "This morning I shall speak to you about Yale, Y-A-L-E, and what it means to me." And for the next 22 minutes, he spoke to the group about why, youth, and how as a youth he had found Yale and Yale had found him. And for 28 minutes, he spoke to the group on A, America, and how Yale had taught him the meaning of America and what it meant to him. And for 33 minutes, he spoke to them about L, about love, about his love for Yale and Yale's love for him. And in the remaining 46 minutes, he spoke to them about E, education, and of the education that he had received at his beloved Yale. And when he had concluded his marathon address, he looked out at the audience and he said, "And that's Y-A-L-E, my beloved Yale." And he sat down. As was the custom, the president of the student body then rose to make responding remarks. With a somewhat dazed look in his eyes, he too looked out at the audience and he said, "All I can think of to say at this moment is that I thank God we are not attending Massachusetts Institute of Technology." And while I have no intention this morning to speak to you in minute detail about the wonders of Nebraska Wesleyan University, though to be sure I could, I would like to take a few moments to talk to you about the E in Wesleyan, about the matter of education. More specifically, I would like to address the matter of higher education, and even more specifically, the matter of higher education in a liberal arts setting. And as I do so, my background and training as a lawyer compels me to immediately issue my disclaimers. I disclaim any expertise in the area. I do not profess to be an expert in the field of higher education, and what I shall say to you this morning will simply be my observations as one who thankfully was exposed to a liberal arts education and who believes it has great value. I should also make it clear at this point that, unlike Secretary of Education Bennett, I have no desire in creating controversy. I seem to have success in doing that without desire, nor to cause discomfort on anyone's part. I simply wish to share some thoughts with you that I have about the importance of higher education. So I need not continue to repeat it. Let me make it clear that when I refer to higher education today, I refer to higher education in a liberal arts university such as Nebraska Wesleyan. As I've indicated, while not an expert, I have from time to time considered the value of an education generally and higher education specifically, and I've concluded that there are many benefits to be realized as a result of one having been given the opportunity to obtain higher education. Yet I fear that there are many today, both on and off campus, who do not appreciate, do not feel the same way, the importance of such an education. Many, I fear, simply do not even understand the question, let alone the answer. In that regard, I'm reminded of the story concerning a large southeastern university known more for its athletic success than its academic success. During class in comparative religion, one of the students, an outstanding athlete, was asked by the professor, "Who threw down the walls of Jericho?" Upon being asked the question, the student immediately rose to his feet, indignantly looked at the professor and said, "Why are you looking at me? I don't know who did it, but I didn't do it." The professor was so frustrated, she immediately went to the coach and advised him of what had transpired. She related the question and the answer she had received from the athlete. The coach looked at her somewhat sympathetically and said, "Look, I don't want to get involved in these matters. I don't know who did it. But I can tell you, Jones is an honest fella. If he says he didn't do it, he didn't do it." The professor was not willing to stop there, and so she carried her frustrations further to the president of the university. She explained the question that she had asked the student and his denial that he had thrown down the walls of Jericho. She further explained that she then saw the coach and related to him what the athlete had said to her, and only to be advised by the coach that the young man always told the truth. At that point, the president of the university said to her, "Look, I don't want to get involved in these matters. I don't know who did it, and I don't know whether Jones is honest. But if it turns out that he did it, we'll pay for it." While my story is obviously apocryphal, I do believe it points up some of the serious problems faced by individuals today at all levels who have not received the benefits of a liberal education. Before we can begin to formulate the answers, we must understand the question. Although it may seem to an outsider that all Americans speak the same language, it's clear that often the words may be the same, but what each is hearing is totally different. There are certainly many varied benefits to be gained by reason of higher education, none the least of which is the ability to make a living, and in many instances, a substantial living. This is a highly technical world we live in today, and benefits to those who have learned the skills of a highly technical world are well known. In a free enterprise system, one who has a talent which few others possess and which is needed by many has a commodity which is easy to sell and which will produce handsome reward. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what the free enterprise system is all about, and I would support that aspect fully. Part of the difficulty in succeeding at that particular goal is the need to know what's current at any particular time. In a highly technical world, the demands and needs of a society change with the technology. In the 60s, it was the engineers, and in the 70s, it was the lawyers. In the 80s, it's the computer specialists. And I suspect in the 90s, it'll be the astronauts. There's nothing wrong with that. And no student who is concerned about obtaining an education so that he or she may engage in a chosen profession and make a good living doing it should be criticized. I've experienced an opposite society, and I, for one, do not opt for such a society. In 1969 and 1970, I served as city attorney of Lincoln, Nebraska. I served as city attorney at a time when many students had no interest in attending college for the purpose of learning skills or earning a living. Rather, they were there to make a statement, to express a view, to change the world. It was an unpleasant experience for me, having to periodically cause the arrest of those young people, and even sadder to have to proceed to prosecute them. Given the choice between the students of the late 60s and early 70s and the students of today, I suspect that I would opt for the latter. But I believe that those are not the only two choices, and in fact, there is a middle ground which should be preferred. That is, I believe that higher education can be used not only for the purpose of making a living, but for the purpose of creating living. That is to say that at one and the same time, an individual can be educated in order to engage in a gainful vocation, while at the same time being educated to improve the quality of life, both for the individual student and for the community in which the student lives. It's my belief that the most serious problem relating to all of this is that we have lost sight of the benefits that can be obtained from education. Here I'm talking about having lost sight of the benefits which can be obtained from an education sought for the sake of simply being informed, for the sake of enhancing the quality of life rather than the quantity of life. An education that is obtained so that we may enjoy what is around us, as opposed to simply obtaining an education so that we may own everything that is around us. Everyone always wants to compare everything in the world to the world of business. There's a belief that if it's done the way it's done in business, it must of necessity be well done. And in that regard, in the tough world of business, what we want to know about is the bottom line. Well, let me then try to talk about a liberal education in the language of the business world. Let me try to share with you what I believe is the bottom line. I believe that the bottom line of a society that has been educated is the benefits realized both individually and collectively. Benefits which makes the world a better place in which to live. I think the reason is fairly simple. Education begets understanding. Understanding begets tolerance. And tolerance begets peace. And in a world that has not known peace for a long time, anything that begets peace is an important bottom line. As simple as that formula is, as sure as that formula is, nevertheless, the formula appears to be rejected by society today. There's a resistance against permitting one to obtain a liberal education for no other purpose except to feel educated and to enhance the quality of life generally. One who is majoring in art appreciation is often viewed as an individual with no sense of direction. Success in our society is measured by dollars. If you want to determine how successful an individual is, you ask to see their tax return. You ask to see the home in which they live. You ask to see the car or cars which they drive and the clothes which they wear. We're not concerned about what they do and how they do it. We're not concerned if they're moral and ethical. We're not concerned if they're honest and caring. We love to be reminded that nice guys finish last. Let someone write a beautiful poem or paint a lovely picture, and it's likely to go mostly unnoticed. Unless it brings a handsome price, then it becomes a good piece of art or work. That is not how the quality of life should be measured. Recognition should be accorded those who create beauty, even if of simple value. There appears to be no great rewards today for majoring in history or comparative religion or literature. Let a student tell his or her parent that the student intends to get a degree in early European history, and the student is likely to get a lecture on the importance of doing something meaningful with their life, which translates into doing something in which the student can make a living. Seldom are questions asked about the quality of that living. I've often envisioned the telephone conversation between Plato and his father. I hear Plato calling and saying, "Dad, I've decided to stay on here at Athens University and get a PhD in philosophy." To which his father replies, "Plato, when are you going to stop fooling around and settle down?" When are you going to start doing something important with your life instead of all of this foolishness? What in the world are you going to do with a PhD in philosophy? Thank goodness for the fact that Plato's father understood the benefit of a liberal education. A society without philosophers is a society without dreams, without plans, without a future, without any idea of where it's going. The philosophical discussions of today often become the lifestyle of tomorrow. It's for that reason that I firmly believe we have a great need to reestablish the importance and the role of a liberal education and those who seek to obtain one. We need to do that for the sake of living and not for the purpose of making a living. The reasons should be obvious. Grayson Kirk some years ago wrote, "The most important function of education at any level is to develop the personality of the individual and the significance of his life to himself and to others." Education is the element of our life which makes us sensitive to our surroundings, which makes us sensitive to the needs of those with whom we interact, and makes us sensitive to what the world requires of us. That element cannot be measured in terms of dollars. The value of that function can only be measured in the quality of life and in the goodness which it brings us. How well do we enjoy the simple, uncomplicated aspects of life? How do we interact with others so that the quality of their life is enhanced? Developing a sensitivity to what is truly moral, to what is truly ethical, and to what is truly good guarantees to each of us a feeling far better than anything which can be artificially induced. It was Samuel Johnson who long ago observed, "The supreme end of education is expert discernment in all things. The power to tell the good from the bad, the genuine from the counterfeit, and to prefer the good and the genuine to the bad and the counterfeit. That which is not real to a good life is more easily turned aside by an educated, understanding society than one which is not." It's not accidental that crimes are committed less frequently by literate, employed, educated persons than by illiterate, unemployed, uneducated. Now, I don't suggest for a moment that the mere fact that one may be literate, may be educated, may be employed, will guarantee that a crime will not be committed. I merely suggest that the numbers of individuals with that background who commit crimes is so significantly less than those without education that what Samuel Johnson detected long ago is borne out by the passage of time. Education is what gives us the ability to act rationally, to act with understanding and with compassion and with a sense of morality. It is what B.F. Skinner described when he said, "Education is what survives when what has been learned has been forgotten." The specifics of the knowledge that the education brings is not what is so important as the general understanding that comes to one who has been educated. Learn to appreciate a beautiful sonata, and you will always appreciate and desire pleasant sounds. Learn and appreciate a beautiful painting, and you will always appreciate and desire what is pleasant to the eye. Learn to appreciate classical writing, and you will always appreciate and desire understanding. Technology may change, facts may be altered, but what sounds pleasant, what looks beautiful, what seems understandable remains forever. One who has learned to understand the philosophers has learned to appreciate what it is they were concerned about and has learned how to reason and will possess that ability forever. If youth is a nation's most precious natural resource, then a higher education is the catalyst needed to most efficiently use that natural resource. Alexis de Tocqueville quickly observed that fact when in the 19th century he toured what was then the United States. He recognized that the surest way to break a caste system is to provide education for the masses. And the mind which has been exposed to higher education and the various disciplines of a liberal arts education is a mind that never shuts down or stops growing. Bishop Mandel Creighton said it best when he said, "The one real object of education is to have a person in the condition of continually asking questions. The surest road to peace and tranquility in a society is a society that constantly wants to know, why can't it be better, and why do we have to kill or be killed? And when considering the role that history plays in our life, one is even more convinced of the needs of a liberal education. It has occurred to me that the principal function of history is not so much to record the past, as if one was maintaining a diary, but rather to give the present an understanding of what occurred in the past so that it may be prevented in the future. A great deal of time and effort has been spent in studying the Holocaust. We do not do that merely because we wish to continually punish ourselves with the unpleasantness of that event, because we wish to continually raise it for the sake of merely dredging up the terrible past. We study it because we want to try to understand what occurred that caused a government to commit so hideous an act. Because we want to believe that if we can understand what occurred before the Holocaust took place, we might prevent such an atrocity from ever happening again. We study the history so that we can understand what it is that caused human beings to act in such an irrational manner. That's the importance of understanding history. That's the importance of understanding ancient history. That's the importance of understanding early European history. That's the importance of understanding American history. It's not so important to remember the exact date upon which Fort Sumter was fired upon as it is to remember what caused the firing. With that understanding, we can hopefully prevent a reoccurrence and thereby improve the quality of life and prevent such wars from being repeated. That's obviously what George Santayana had reference to when he said, if people do not recall history, they are required to relive history. And what Henry Peter meant when he said, education makes a people easy to lead, but difficult to drive. Easy to govern, but impossible to enslave. An educated society is the best defense against anyone's attempt to restrict freedom. It's the best defense against the evils of war and the best defense against the ravages of crime. That's probably what A. Whitney Griswold was thinking when he wrote, in the long run of history, the censor and the inquisitor have always lost. The only sure weapon against bad ideas is better ideas. The source of better ideas is wisdom. The surest path to wisdom is a liberal education. That's the benefit of an education. A liberally educated society neither needs nor permits others to make choices for it. It makes its own choices and charts its own destiny, most often in a calm and thoughtful way. As you may know, I have a great interest in the field of law and have spent a great deal of time attempting with others to find ways in which we might enhance lawyer competence. One of the suggestions that has been made, a suggestion which I strongly oppose, is that we develop a prescribed pre-law curriculum, much as pre-medicine, and that we should no longer permit people to come to law school who have not taken a rigid, prescribed pre-law program. Today, one may apply to law school if he or she possesses a Bachelor of Science or Bachelor of Arts or Bachelor of Fine Arts, if one is a graduate of engineering, of business, of humanities. And I have opposed any change in that regard because I have firmly believed that the most important quality of a lawyer, as any thinking person, is that the lawyer be intelligent, be sensitive, and be understanding to the needs of society. I know of no better way to acquire such intelligence, such sensitivity, or such understanding than in the humanities. I believe that by bringing to the law persons with such varied backgrounds, we enhance the quality of the law, and to eliminate that process would not improve lawyers' competence, but only diminish it. It's for that reason that I believe that efforts must be made to once again reestablish the proper position of a liberal education, to once again make the study of the humanities a respectable and important endeavor by individuals who will one day be society's leaders. We must slow down the need to be through with our education as quickly as possible so that we can get on with the business of earning a living. it may be that several years of a liberal education should be a prerequisite to any career, regardless of what it may be. We probably need to defer acquiring our earning skills until we have acquired our living skills. We need to understand more about ourselves and our surroundings in a society which has become a me society, in a society in which half of all people who marry divorce and a third who remarry divorce again, in a society that seeks comfort in pills and drugs and other artificial stimulants, a great need for something better exists. If music soothes the savage beast, it also soothes the troubled mind. It does it only when we have been exposed to it and we can understand it. As I near my conclusion, I'd like to share one final story with you, one which I believe apropos to our discussion in a number of ways. The story is told about a couple who had a young daughter, very carefully raised at home, very well protected. That's not a sexist story. I have two daughters, protected both of them. She finally graduated from high school, went off to college. The family decided now it was time for her to get on her way, to learn how to do things on her own. So they decided that they would not write to her unless and until she first wrote to them. That would teach her responsibility. And so when they hadn't heard from her for the first 2 weeks, they weren't concerned. They understood that things had to get adjusted. When they hadn't heard from her by the third week, they were a little more concerned, but understanding. When they hadn't heard from her by the fourth week, they were nearly panicked. You can well imagine that by the time the letter arrived on the eighth week, they were out of their mind. They madly tore the letter open and they read it. The letter said, "Dear Mom and Dad, I'm sorry I've not written to you sooner, but until the cast was removed from my arm, I couldn't hold a pen." "Oh, don't be concerned about my arm," the letter said. "Everyone here in jail tells me that the nurse who set my arm did a wonderful job. And I will regain full strength in my arm. They assure me that I'll have all the strength back even before the baby is born." No. And I've heard from John, and he believes that with time off for good behavior, he'll be out of prison even before the baby is born, and we can establish a home for our child. And then there was a break in the letter. And then the letter went on and said, "Dear Mom and Dad, please don't be upset by anything I've said to you thus far. None of it is true. But I need to tell you that I'm going to get a D in French. And before I did it, I simply wanted to put everything in its proper perspective." We too, I believe, need to begin putting things in their proper perspective. I confessed at the outset that I was not an expert in this field. That was not false modesty. Therefore, I'm not prepared or equipped to suggest how we get ourselves and our universities back on track. It certainly cannot be done without the support of society generally. However, it must be done. It must begin at once. More of our young people need to be encouraged and commended for seeking higher education in the liberal arts, regardless of what they later do with their careers. Education for the sake of education must become a reward in itself. I take a few minutes to talk to you about one aspect of that education that troubles me sorely, and I confess, as I have already, I have no answer to it. I talk about the matter of grades in a liberal arts education. I teach a course at the University of Nebraska College of Law. It is one of the most pleasant things I do in my life. I look forward each spring to going out to the college and meeting with these wonderful students, senior law students, bright, questioning. And we have a great time during the entire semester. At the end of the semester, then I must rank them. I must decide who is 91 and who is 89, and who is 84 and who is 78. I haven't the faintest idea what that means. I have no idea how I determine who is 91 and who is 89. And when I put them all together, I still don't know what that means. Grades have become to education what money has become to employment. It is an end in itself without any real meaning. As nobody wants to know how much you know about your career, but only how much you made, Nobody wants to know how much you know, just where did you rank? And that has an effect on people. Nobody wants to know where I graduated in my class. What they care about is, do I understand what the law is all about? And if I told them where I stood, and it was very high in the class, they couldn't care less. But I recall as an undergraduate sorely wanting to take a class in arc welding. I wanted to do it because I thought it would be fun to do sculpting with welding. That would be great, twisting pieces and putting them together. Now, I happen to be one of those kinds of people who, if 3 out of 4 times I can close my car door without catching my hand in it, I believe that I have displayed manual dexterity. And to therefore take a course in arc welding, fearful that I would get a D in the course and not get into law school, was not something that I could do. I had to pick and choose courses for the future of my career, not just for the sake of understanding. When we grade students, do we know what they know or what they understand? And do we care? Is it just that we want to know what they know or what they understand? Now, I don't know what the answer to that one is. Maybe pass fail and a note home to mother. I don't know how we change the system, but I'm convinced that something needs to be done so that students are encouraged to take courses that may appear difficult for them, but important for them. That when they're through with the course, that they have understanding of the discipline and not just be able to parrot back. I can memorize all of the elements. There are now more to memorize than when I was an undergraduate. I can memorize them all. Is it important that I memorize them, or important that I know what to do with them, know what they mean? And I think grades have an effect on our ability to do that. And to you, the students, I suggest to you, it is important for you to understand and not just to know. That it is important when you look at a painting to know what the life of the artist was at that moment, what his physical condition was, what emotions he was going through. You look at Van Gogh and you know where in his range of sanity he was, and the paintings take on a whole different meaning. You want to read Shakespeare, you have to know the history of the times. You can't just sit down and read Shakespeare and think you're going to come away with an understanding of it. You have to know what was going on in the countryside when he was writing it, what was compelling him to do that sort of thing. And so you need this broad general education. And so I urge you, take some chances and get in there and dig it out, and don't just worry about memorizing the material. If our desire in America is to improve the quality of life and enhance the people's ability to deal with problems, if our purpose in America is to ease tensions and eliminate emotional distress, then I suggest we spend less time developing automatic foot massagers and television channel changers and more time encouraging the study of the humanities and a liberal education. That we elevate society's respect for those who do study the humanities, and particularly for those who teach the humanities. Only through education generally, and a liberal higher education specifically, can we hope to produce an end product that will stand the ravages of time. This should be our first priority, and when that is accomplished, I believe we will have succeeded in providing for each of us not only the ability to earn a living, but the ability to live as well. Thank you very, very much.
I really share your thoughts on the grade. The one thing that concerns me, and I love your analogy with the incentive of money, but one thing that I would ask you is, are law schools accepting or admitting students with low GPAs?
Of course not. Of course not. Oh, no, no, this is not criticism from on high. This has to happen everywhere and probably has to happen in the professional schools first. Not only are law schools not admitting people without high averages, but people aren't employing those who don't graduate in the class. Oh, absolutely. But you know, there's an interesting thing about that I have to share with you. Each year I go through a number of applications of individuals who are seeking positions as being a clerk for me during the year. Somebody has got to be in the bottom half of the class. Now, if you only have four people, two of them have to be in the bottom half of the class. There is no way mathematically to avoid that, I'm told. But you know that if the only people you admit to law school are the top 4% of the undergraduate schools, you've got some awfully bright people who are at the bottom of the class. I mean, we have narrowed it down to such a place that it's silly to talk about that. The law schools, the medical schools, the professional schools are undoubtedly the cause of the problem, or in part. But all of it's got to come to an end. All of it's got to come to an end. We've got to start worrying more about what do people really understand than the bar examination is a perfect example. It took me a number of years to finally convince bar examiners across the country, I think I've succeeded finally, that the purpose of the bar examination is not to test competence, but to test incompetence. You can't test competence. Competence comes with time. What we want to know is the last five people who, if given the right answer, wouldn't recognize it. Perhaps that's what testing in college ought to be about. Find the last five people in the class who, if you gave the right answer to, they wouldn't know it belonged in that course. Get rid of them and go on with the rest of the people, encouraging them to continue to learn. You don't stop learning when you get out of college. That's not the end of knowledge. That's not the end of understanding. And God knows, in a world today that where we're discovering things faster than we can catalog them, that thinking that this is it and walking away is the ability to learn that's important, not what you learn. Anyone else? Please. Yes, excuse me.
I was going to say, I appreciate your telling, but I have a degree in fine arts and education, and I only taught for 1 year, and then I didn't like that very well. And I got into something else just in regular business. I found that it was, for me personally, it was a myth that you were going to get more money for education. I found that seniority held a higher priority than education, but there was an enrichment that I got that I felt the other people were a little envious of.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, and I was wondering what you were graduated, what degree you had before you got into law.
I had what no longer even exists. It was a Bachelor of Science in Law that is no longer even awarded. It was a program that was designed to let you pick and choose, to take business courses, to take liberal arts courses, to take welding if I had the guts, to take whatever you wanted to do with it. What you say, it just strikes such a wonderful bell. Let somebody graduate from Harvard and become a garbage collector. You make the front of the New York Times. Harvard graduate becomes garbage collector. And I asked the fellow, why did you do that? Well, he says, I like the hours. By noon, I'm through. I have time for myself. I like working outside. What does one have to do with the other? Who were the first astronomers? Who were the first astrologers? Who were the first poets? The shepherds, they're sitting around on the countryside. I mean, you don't earn much with it, but you sure make the world a better place to live. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
seems I read somewhere, I don't know if it was Berger, one of the Supreme Court justices said that a lot of the decisions that are made, as a matter of fact, I think he said 90%, aren't really made, you know, that when it comes to the Supreme Court, it's not made on some specific critical concrete thing of the law, but it's kind of your gut feeling when it really gets down to it. Now, would you agree with that, and would you say that liberal arts and a humanitarian, humanistic perspective is valuable there?
Well, I, first of all, I think I'd make a distinction perhaps between the United States Supreme Court and the Nebraska Supreme Court only to this extent. The Nebraska Supreme Court is a court of appeal as a matter of right. We must accept every case that's filed. So lots of cases that we take and decide are strictly questions of law, interpretation of the law. The United States Supreme Court is a court of appeal as a matter of discretion. They get 5,000 applications a year, and they select 180 of those cases to take. Obviously, then, the cases they select are cases that they perceive have an emotional impact, a philosophical impact on society. It's not just the simple question of whether or not the individual was intoxicated while driving. And yes, of course, I would think that an understanding of the world in which we live in, it is important to understand what the rules about the world in which we live in should be, and would be terribly critical for somebody to understand that, particularly for the United States Supreme Court. Yes?
You made the comment about getting the universities back on track. I guess I would question whether they ever have been on track. I'll give you a comment that was made in an editorial, I think was a month or so ago in the Chronicle of Higher Education, where the woman that was writing the article was maintaining that Americans have never had the desire to be educated, but rather it's to be trained. Now, I don't know, would you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I told you at the outset that I was going to leave all of that to Secretary Bennett. I don't think that's true. Now, obviously, I haven't been on the scene since the beginning, and therefore, I have to tell you what I see and what I've felt. My reaction, however, must be that when universities began in this country, the humanities, liberal arts, played a much more significant role than it does today. Yale and Harvard have to believe that. I mean, they were started to a large extent because of those disciplines. I'd have to believe that that's probably not true. That there was a time in this country when being an engineer was, or a lawyer or a doctor was not the be all and end all, and that people who did have knowledge and understanding were looked up to. I think that has to be true. Anyone? Yes, sir.
Would you comment on changing the Constitution so the president can have more than two terms, and conversely, changing it so that it would be 1 6-year term?
Yes. It seems to me that, and now we're really getting to the areas where I have no expertise, which makes it easier. I have no restrictions there. It seems to me that all of those kinds of rules about numbers of terms presumes that the people can't take care of themselves. I mean, after all, if there are unlimited terms, the office holder doesn't get to be there by right. The people get to cast a ballot each time. And if they're knowing, if they're understanding, I mean, if somebody's doing a good job, why not let them remain in office? Well, the argument is made that, well, then they're constantly seeking to be reelected. Well, I don't think that understands the mentality of lots of people who seek public office. I mean, the current president is certainly not a lame duck president. He's not going to run again, can't, I mean, sit around in California and not make any difference. He is not a lame duck president. He's the president of the United States. Now, if in fact you can't run for re-election, that makes you a lame duck president. Does that mean 1 6-year term that's all we'll ever have are lame duck presidents? And the moment they get into office, they can't seek re-election. Therefore, that's the end of it. My reaction is that the benefit of a free society is to let the people vote. And if they want to vote for somebody forever, I guess that's their right to do it. I want them to be knowledgeable. I want them to be educated. And then after that, I want to let them do whatever they want. So I'm not much enthused about any terms of office. Yes, Dick?
I want to believe you when you say that the pursuit of humanistic values will produce eventually a more humane society. You also mentioned the Holocaust. Help me to reconcile that with the fact that the society that produced the Holocaust was also a cultured society interested in its own cultural history and values.
Well, I suspect the truth of the matter, though, is that it was a cultured society, but was not a cultured society in 1936 and 1937. There were people in universities. But how could it have been a cultured society who believed that the economic conditions of the country were due to particular people? Or who could believe that the country had a right to acquire more room simply because they had a God-given right to acquire more room? When I talk about a knowledgeable, understanding society, I'm talking about one which is able to analyze all of those factors. Hitler did not come to power by force. Hitler was elected to office and gained his greatest momentum with the support of the people. I mean, an army that he had at the beginning could not have done what he did, except that people were inclined to go along. Now, those were people who didn't have the understanding and intellect to ask the kinds of questions and to refuse to accept the kinds of answers that was a part of that history, I think. That's my view. Yes, sir?
Well, in the same terms, I'd have to say that it could be very, in terms of the German people, it have to be very much argued that their culture relates to not questioning your authoritarian figures. They just were not culturally disposed to questioning for those. And they only had elections for a very short period of time before the time of Hitler. And so they just simply were not culturally disposed to making judgments about their authoritarian figures.
You would say that in terms of what I...
They didn't think of whether in terms of government was doing right or wrong because they just were not accustomed to judging their authoritarian
figures. And then that would be, to me, a society that was not understanding.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today, University Forum has presented the Honorable Norman Krivosha, Chief Justice of the Nebraska Supreme Court. He spoke on education for the sake of living as well as making a living. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.